a body is discovered dumped in a suburban garage.
Who is he? Who killed him? And why? And how can science help us discover what happened in Operation Drake?
A crime scene is a puzzle that has to be solved. A whodunit, a scattering of clues to be deciphered by clever detective work and the power of science. It's summertime, January, in New Plymouth City. An ordinary afternoon will become anything but when a couple go into their garage for a tool to fix a child's toy.
They'd gone into their garage during the afternoon just to get something from there when they noted some objects in there that weren't familiar with the garage, and they had a closer look, which led them to finding the body.
They had no idea who the deceased was. In fact, they only had a fleeting sight of his leg.
They were shocked, they were scared, they were quite distraught about the whole situation they found themselves to be in.
They first get the young children away from the house, then drive to the city's police station to report their shocking discovery. Officers are immediately dispatched to the scene.
When I got to Drake Street, there was a police attendance there, of course, where they were just taping the scene off with police emergency tape. We approached the body to determine, firstly, that it's a deceased, and we were clearly able to do that quickly.
A brief examination revealed some very disturbing details.
The deceased was hogtied with cable ties. His head and face was taped with, wrapped around with tape. A body that's hogtied, very rare. Every homicide's different, and this was clearly different by the state of the deceased.
I got a call from Detective Senior Sergeant Grant Coward. I was out at a friend's hen's night on the Friday night, and I think it was around 10 o'clock in the evening. They had found a body in a garage in New Plymouth. That was about all they had, unknown male, and that they would need us to come up and assist with the scene examination the next day.
While the ESR forensic team travelled from Wellington, police began working on the first priority, identify the victim.
To identify, you first see if there's any documents or phones or anything on them that might identify who they are, and we didn't find anything.
We spent quite a bit of time contacting Police National Headquarters to check their missing person database, and that came up blank. Identification of a victim of a homicide, for me as an investigator, is critical. The moment you identify the victim, you've got a starting point for any investigation.
We get fully clothed up, and this is to protect us from the scene itself and to protect the scene from us. Generally, we approach a scene by just starting from the outside and working inwards. We use what we call stepping plates that allow us access to the scene without stepping on the ground itself and treading on any evidence such as blood staining that may be present. So the garage, it was fairly cluttered. In the far back right corner was a pile of bedding, and you could see that there was actually a body. A male lying on his back. His lower half was still encased in what appeared to be a sleeping bag. He was naked apart from wearing a pair of underpants. His hands and ankles were tied with tape and cable ties, and they were pulled behind his back as well.
At that point, it wasn't obvious how he died. There's clearly a lot of blood. A head injury was probably the most obvious.
The priority is to identify the man, but the process of fingerprinting could disturb other evidence on the body.
We know that the offenders have to have handled the cable ties and the tape that were put on the body. So we decided that the cable ties were an important piece of evidence, and we were going to collect them first before any fingerprinting was done. They had to be cut off and carefully removed one by one, notes made of which cable tie came from which area of the body, assigning it a police exhibit number, and then the police would exhibit and package them appropriately. I also took samples from under the fingernails and on the hands of the deceased. The body was able to be fingerprinted and then removed from the garage sort of around 5:30 on the end of the first day.
The fingernail and hand swabs were sent to Auckland's ESR to be analysed by DNA expert Heidi Baker. They're routinely taken from all homicide victims, potential clues to an attacker's identity.
Does it require an altercation? Do you have to get physical to leave skin cells?
No, absolutely not. So, for example, if we were to shake hands, just by that action, we've each transferred our DNA to the other person. But if, for example, I were to... My apologies. But, for example, I've just scratched you, so I'm more likely to have more of your DNA, and it's going to be localised under my fingernails, which is going to make it much easier to detect.
10 years ago, scientists needed a bloodstain the size of a 50-cent coin to get a DNA profile. But advances mean profiles can now be identified from a single cell.
How do we get the skin cells from underneath your fingernails?
Well, there's a few different techniques. We could try scraping underneath my nails. We could actually clip the fingernails. And in this instance, Janet's really kindly offered to wet and dry swab, and that should be quite an effective way of collecting any DNA material that's there.
What happens next?
So in the lab, the DNA is going to be extracted from those swabs. So we'll cut the swab heads off and we'll soak them in some solution and then break open the cells and release the DNA. And that's the first step.
What are you actually looking for?
So a lot of our DNA is the same because, you know, we're human. We've both got two arms, two legs, all of those sorts of things our DNA has in common. But the things that make us unique and the areas that we target for forensic DNA testing are those areas that we know differ between people. And so we look at 15 DNA sites that we know differ quite greatly between individuals.
This graph shows the DNA at each of the 15 markers. Higher peaks are stronger results. When Heidi Baker analysed the DNA in this case, the strong results all corresponded to the victim.
Were you able to identify any other profiles?
Yes, there was a trace of additional DNA. By trace, I just mean a really small amount of additional human DNA, but unfortunately not enough to determine who it could have come from.
It was now 24 hours since the man was discovered. Investigators were waiting on the outcome of fingerprint analysis, hoping it would at last give them a name.
We got a result on the fingerprints early evening on the Saturday night, and he was identified as being Dean Brown, who was known to live in the Auckland area.
As far as Mr. Brown himself, we knew that he was on some active charges for some domestic type things, but it appeared that he was living by himself in a mobile home next to a house in the North Shore. How did he come to be in a garage in New Plymouth was the question on our mind.
We were in bed. Faye thought she heard a noise.
A torch through the door. Someone tapping on the door with a torch. And it was a detective. And we thought, what's going on? We thought maybe they're looking for Dean. And he said, well, I know he's not here. We found him in New Plymouth. I said, what's he doing down there? And he said, I'm sorry, he's dead. And I laughed at this guy. I said, you've got to be joking. He said, no, I'm sorry, can I come in?
We knew he had left Auckland. He spent 10 days in remand at Mount Eden, which scared the living daylights out of him. He went on the run because he didn't want to get locked up again.
Dean was one I never had to worry about. I never felt I needed to worry. Mm. I always felt
he could look after himself.
Dean
was over 6 foot. He was quite handsome.
He liked nice things. He liked nice wines. He liked the nice food. He was into boating. He loved boating, yachting. He bought a caravan and started doing it up with his brother. And that's what he was living in up to the time we last saw him.
One of the questions we were asked fairly early on was whether it looked like the deceased had been killed in the garage. It seemed fairly obvious early on that it was unlikely that he had been.
There was no sign of any struggle within that garage. It looked like a dumping ground for a body.
The main area of interest was a green car mat from a boot. Lifting the wheel up and examining the mat was bloodstained. There was a little bit of bloodstaining where the mat and where the body was. It almost looked like he had possibly been dragged across the concrete floor. Also of interest, the mat itself was partially worn, but you could just see the manufacturer's label on it. The mat had came from a Toyota Corolla.
We had a murder scene somewhere that we needed to find. Where did this happen? Why did it happen? You know, who's done it? How many are involved? What's gone on?
I was of the view that it was probably unlikely that it was a random garage that this body had been dumped in. The couple would be the key to unfolding this investigation, and they were very helpful, and information was coming, albeit slowly, as it always does.
The couple in the house didn't know Dean Brown. The night before, two men that they knew had arrived, and they had left approximately lunchtime on the Friday. It was after that they'd left on the Friday, they'd gone out to the shed, which led them to finding the body. They gave us descriptions of the vehicle that the two men were in. It was a white hatchback. They knew them as Mikhail and Little C.
As detectives, we're always looking out for his names, and particularly local, you generally get a good feel for people locally. But that name, Mikhail Pandy Johnson and Little C, had no reference for us here in Taranaki at all. We'd never heard of them.
After we'd finished examining the garage, we went inside and actually examined the interior of the house. There was no bloodstaining located in the house, no signs of a struggle anywhere where wounds had been inflicted to someone. There were also several drinking vessels, such as cups and bottles, around the house and in the kitchen. These were sampled just in case it became important to say who had actually been in the house.
Outside, police were going door to door in the Drake Street area, asking residents for any sighting of unusual activity. A routine inquiry unexpectedly provides an early breakthrough.
While the detectives were doing the area canvas, the eagle-eyed detective saw what he thought was a white Toyota Corolla and looked very suspicious with three persons in. He alerted his mate, and they managed to find a police vehicle and pursued them, which was at some speed as they left the Drake Street area down towards the centre of town. As soon as they realised that they were being pursued, they abandoned the vehicle and ran. I don't know why offenders do what they do. You know, you would think that would be a very stupid thing to do, but they must have had some sort of motivation to, I wonder if we should go back and get him, or are the police on to us? We'll drive up there and see if there's a police car there. I have no idea why they do what they do, but it seems it was their downfall. Quite honestly.
When the car was found, there was a bag that had a sawn-off shotgun, which was loaded. Also in the car was a chainsaw. Discovering the firearms certainly elevated the risk that we perceived for public. We took it really seriously and felt the need to locate them was paramount.
Unfortunately for one, Reece Fournier, he didn't run fast enough and he was caught by the guys.
He was spotted by police jogging across the grounds just outside the New Plymouth prison, but the other two were nowhere to be found.
At this stage, Mikhail Pandy Johnson and Little C, who came to be known as Carl Nuku, were considered suspects, obviously. The armed offender squad were on alert, of course, and engaged to find these two that were on the loose. And what we now had was a manhunt.
The car was taken to a secure garage and examined by myself and my colleague. On the back of the bumper area, there was some, what I'd describe as dilute-looking bloodstaining, very faint and hard to see, almost like it had been partially washed away. Of note was that There was no spare tyre in the spare tyre well. The wooden cover was missing, and also there was no boot carpet. Those three items were located in the garage at Drake Street. It was interesting to note that they were missing from this vehicle. The bloodstaining in the boot of the car was what I would classify as transfer bloodstaining. So there was nothing to suggest that the body had actually been killed in the car.
They were armed and dangerous, we thought. So their photographs went into the local Taranaki Daily News. I think that would have been in Monday's publication. One of the Armed Defender Squad members had a mate who was travelling through to Stratford for work, and he rang him. He said, "You fellas looking for a guy, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "I think I've seen him." They were in a plain car, the two Armed Defenders guys, and Nuku just thought he was, his luck was in, and he was going to get a ride in a car, but it was two Armed Defenders guys in a plain car.
Hours later, again after being recognised from the newspaper, the third suspect, Mikhail Pandy Johnson, joined the other two in custody.
Now, this is where the investigation pretty much starts. There's a view from the general public, to a degree, is that once the offenders are caught, well done, police, thanks for keeping our streets safe, carry on. But actually, that's the start of the investigation, because now we have to build a case.
Police had three men in custody and a car which appeared to have been used to transport the body. Are any of these three the killers, or were they only involved with a dead body? Can science provide answers?
There were a number of miscellaneous items located in the car.
There were things like cell phones, various identification, a bag with a shopping receipt which was from a supermarket in Wellington, and that had some cleaning type products in the bag.
The shopping bag appeared to contain items such as cloths, a bottle of bleach, some gloves. Of note, there was some faint bloodstaining on the outside of the bag, and on the inside were also some fibres. We could just see some loose fibres on the inside of the bag.
Fibres had also been identified on tape from the bedding around the body.
So I sent those off to our physical evidence laboratory in Auckland just to see if there was a link between the fibres in those two locations.
Investigators were hoping fibres at the murder scene had become attached to the tape in the shopping bag, a useful clue or evidence to build a case. I'm meeting with Dr. Sally Coulson at Auckland ESR to find out how fibre analysis works.
We can have a look at your jacket for some fibres if you want.
Okie dokie.
So next we look at it under the microscope. You can see that there's lots of fibres in there, and most of those will have no relevance at all to the specific case or the fibres we're looking for. We would be looking for fibres from a particular garment. So what we would do is we would search this tape lift for any fibres that match what we call our target fibre. We circle it with a pen so we know exactly where it is. Our next stage is to carefully remove each of those fibres and to mount them onto slides.
In this case, similar pink fibres were found in each sample, which were then compared at a higher magnification.
They're different thicknesses straight away. They seem to have the same form in respect that they are essentially a long tube.
So because these are wool fibres, we expect a reasonable amount of variation in the thickness, just because wool is produced by a sheep and so it's a natural process. You might have also seen that we can see the scales on the surface, so that immediately tells me that's a wool fibre and not a cotton fibre or another type of synthetic.
So straight away, looking through this microscope, you can tell the difference between fibre sources.
Absolutely. Cotton fibres, it doesn't have the scales, and the fibre has a twist in it, like a ribbon.
They're very different, aren't they?
So a synthetic fibre will have a nice even diameter. There won't be any scales like the wool, and it won't be a ribbon shape.
The pink wool fibres were then compared under fluorescent light, again appearing very similar.
So this is a microspectrophotometer, and it's a way of measuring colour. So this gives us another way to compare colour of fibres rather than just by eye using the microscope. and the little black square is the area where we'll measure the colour. And we'll do that on a number of places on each fibre. And what we're looking for here is the shape of the line, because they've all got the same general shape. That tells me that they've been dyed with the same dye, and therefore they are the same colour.
Pink wool, that's quite unusual, isn't it, as a colour?
Well, it is for clothing, so New Zealanders tend to wear dark clothes, so dark blue or black or grey. So straight away we knew that we're looking for a source of pink wool fibres. That could be clothing, but it might be some other type of item, such as carpet or upholstery.
Investigators still didn't know where Dean Brown was killed, but they did not believe it was in New Plymouth. While they continued to trace his last known movements, police now had a cause of death.
The post-mortem is a critical examination in any homicide investigation. It confirmed our suspicions that the deceased had been beaten about the head. One injury in particular showed that he had a circular depression in his skull, which clearly had been cracked by what we believe to be a blunt instrument. And if you were going to take a punt on what that was, it would be the round head of a hammer. There was no sign of a struggle. Mr. Brown had no defence wounds. You know, he obviously wasn't up with his hands like this trying to protect his head, because there was no injuries on his arms.
One possible scenario was he'd been tied up, then attacked. Based on the lack of bruises or marks on his wrists and ankles, the pathologist did not believe this was the case.
He's been tied with the cable ties after the beating and after death, probably. The words from the pathologist was that the deceased died from a blunt instrument blow to the head.
After we had arrested the three suspects, we identified that Penny Johnson and Nuku had been staying in Auckland, and a search warrant was executed on their property.
Potentially their home address could well have been where the murder had actually taken place. So we were conscious of the fact that the address could be forensically sensitive. Although the place was very untidy, dishevelled, poorly kept, there was a lot of dust everywhere. You could see that nothing had been moved for a long time. There was no sign that anything of that nature had occurred at the address. Obviously, because it was linked to our suspects, we were going to search it thoroughly. It was a black sheer-lined briefcase there, just a typical briefcase. We opened it up and found it had a set of green overalls and two claw hammers, and on initial examination, both the two hammers and the overalls appeared to have blood on them. There was a driver's license and other documentation linked to our deceased. From memory, I think there was about 30 items in all in the briefcase. A good proportion of those were certainly items of interest to the inquiry, yes.
From attending the post-mortem, it became clear that Mr. Brown had been bludgeoned with an instrument that could well have been a hammer. And on finding those two bloodstained items, they were significant in terms of the investigation.
Investigators now knew both the suspects and the victim were all from Auckland, but could not establish the link between them.
In the early part of our investigation, we did not know how Dean became associated with Nuku and Penny Johnson at all.
Even when we saw them on the news in court when they first appeared, didn't know them at all.
Never seen them, never even heard of them. And we thought, who are these people? I mean, they're not sort of the sort of people Dean used to associate with.
The three suspects, Mikhail Pandy Johnson, Carl Nuku and Rhys Fournier, called themselves the Killer Clown Fiends.
Although it was really only the three of them that appeared to be in that group.
We'd heard of the killer bees and gangs like that, but not killer clown fiends.
Throughout the house there was a lot of posters, a number of clowns pulling aggressive faces, I guess a bit like the clown of the Batman movies.
The motto was a clown head. It was brightly coloured clothing that they wore, a lot of just colours of purple and green that were associated with that clown face.
They did have their jackets with little patches on the side that said killer clown, fiends and that type of thing. So they obviously thought they were part of a little group, and their motivation appeared to be drug offending.
We're talking methamphetamine, cannabis, and you know other types of illicit drugs.
Whether they were making money, who knows, but that was certainly their motivation.
I think we returned from New Plymouth on the Tuesday, and then Wednesday morning we got a call that there was a house in Oriental Bay in Wellington that was of interest to the police.
We had information that they had been at an address in Oriental Parade in Wellington, and a search warrant was executed. It was a really fast moving inquiry. A lot of information was coming in.
Oriental Parade is one of the most sought after addresses in the city. Police focus on a dilapidated two-storey house right in the middle of the million-dollar homes.
From memory, it was a student flat where there were several rooms, I think maybe six or seven different bedrooms that were rented out to different individuals, and in particular one of the rooms at this address that became of interest to the police.
On my initial entry to the house, and at the foot of the stairs, I saw a skateboard leaning up against a door showing signs of blood on the door edge at the bottom, along with small traces of blood around the door handle. Items of interest were found in that bedroom at the top of the stairs. There were squares of cut out cardboard masked with tape placed over squares of missing carpet on the floor, which set alarm bells ringing as to why. As a result of that, the house was cleared of the residents. The scene was cordoned off, ESR were contacted, along with a forensic photographer.
I started with the staircase, nothing visible on the staircase itself, and then we entered the bedroom and examined the bedroom. One of the things I noticed straight away was that the carpet, there were areas where there were holes in the carpet, square holes, and three other areas where pieces of cardboard had been taped onto the carpet. I lifted the cardboard off the carpet, and the holes themselves looked quite square and uniform. There was a two-seater sofa bed against one of the walls. When we took the cushions off the sofa bed, we could see that the mattress itself from the sofa bed was missing. And the mechanism, the fold-out mechanism, was secured with a black cable tie.
The cable tie had to be cut in order to open out the bed. They also found an open bag of cable ties at the house.
Very similar to what was found on the deceased in New Plymouth. Visual traces of blood were seen on the side of the bed frame when opened out.
It looked like blood had dripped down, run down the side of the frame. So there was no visible blood staining on the actual fabric, bit of the sofa bed, but we carried out luminol testing of the room, the carpet, and the bed itself.
Luminol testing is routinely used at crime scenes, but how does it actually work?
So luminol will show me blood that I can't actually see with my naked eye.
Yes.
How does it do that?
It's a liquid. We apply it in the dark, and the hemoglobin that's present in the traces of blood reacts with the chemicals and undergoes what's called a chemiluminescent reaction.
So why does it actually glow? What's happening?
The light is emitted as a byproduct of the reaction. So various chemical reactions will have various byproducts. Some release heat, some release gases. In this case, it's emitting light.
We're going to do a test now. You've got some blood there, haven't you?
Yes, I have. So we can put some blood on this piece of lino. You can try and clean it up. And then we can test it with luminol to see if we can detect the traces.
By doing that now, there is no visible blood, is there?
I can't see any blood on that surface anymore.
Wow.
Yeah, I can see it's already starting to glow through here, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. You can see that really well, can't you?
You can really see where I've wiped the blood.
And are we talking on all sorts of surfaces here?
Yes, we've had results with luminol on carpet, lino, concrete, grass, all sorts of surfaces.
Does it have to be new blood?
No, it doesn't. Luminol will react with old blood as well as new blood.
Does it destroy the blood at the scene of the crime?
No, the traces will still remain, and if there are sufficient there, we can take samples and hopefully still get a DNA profile.
Suspecting a clean-up at the Oriental Parade house, investigators made extensive use of luminol.
There were some luminol-positive areas around the holes in the carpet. There were several areas of possible bloodstaining detected on the cushions and on the front edge of both sides of the sofa. Finding the bloodstaining in that room, we luminol tested out into the hallway and down the staircase.
And to be honest, it was like a neon lights on a skyscraper.
What we found that there was a small area that reacted with luminol in the middle of each step that indicated a bloodstained object had touched the edge of the step and left traces of bloodstaining behind. It was looking likely that this was where Mr. Brown had been killed.
At this stage, we had four crime scenes.
The scene in New Plymouth, where Dean was found, the scene in Auckland, where the weapons and overalls and Dean's licence were found. We had a scene in Wellington, which was established. That was where the murder took place. We had the car in New Plymouth, which again was a scene. So, yeah, geographically, it was growing.
The occupant of the bedroom initially claimed the holes in the carpet were from wear, not cut out to hide blood evidence. Edges of the missing carpet were examined under the microscope.
The fact that all the fibres within the threads are the same length and they're quite even across, that indicates that they're more likely to have been cut rather than worn. And I was also looking at to see whether I could say anything about whether it was old or recent. The fact that they're still quite neat and even and tidy indicates it's more recently been cut.
Samples from the carpet were sent to Dr. Sally Coulson to see if they matched fibres from the tape and shopping bag.
We had 17 pink wool fibres from the tape and 12 pink wool fibres from the shopping bag, and all of those matched the fibres that were in the carpet.
Providing scientific proof that the body and products in the suspect's car were linked to the Oriental Parade bedroom. Investigators now focus their attention on the cable ties on the body and those found at the Oriental Bay house.
How would you link cable ties? Because they're mass-produced, they're all the same, aren't they?
So at the time of the request, we weren't sure on how we were going to do it either. So our first port of call was to look in the forensic literature to see if anyone had ever published a paper describing how you can compare cable ties. And luckily somebody had.
First, there's the code which identifies the factory mould they were made in.
You can see the letters G8G on each cable tie. And if you look at that last G, on the end of the flat portion, there's a small dimple mark. And that's caused by an imperfection in the mould. And because we can see it on both cable ties, it's even more evidence that they were made in that same mould. Also look at this round circle, which is beside the number, and that's caused by the metal pin that is used to eject the cable tie from its mould. And it's left behind quite a large number of what we call striations. They look like lines, and these ones are on an angle. Those metal pins will change over time, the more that they wear and the more they're used. And those striated details will change. So if we have both the code matching and the pin mark matching, then we know that those two cable ties have been made within a short space of time of each other. So this is very strong evidence, because we've got seven cable ties on the deceased that match cable ties in the bag at Oriental Parade.
As the evidence built, so did the police's picture of what had happened to Dean Brown.
Oriental Parade was where the murder happened. That was where Dean was killed. Dean was asleep on a sofa bed in one of the bedrooms.
Mr. Brown was beaten in that bedroom by an instrument which we believe to be a hammer. It appears that Mr. Nuku was there and Mr. Fournier was there. We're fairly satisfied that Mr. Mikhail Pandy Johnson wasn't there. he was then hogtied, bundled into some bedding and taken downstairs and dumped in the boot of that car.
Pandy Johnson, we understand he arrived soon after Dean had been killed and assisted in taking him out to the car.
He had planned it and got his boys, if you like, to do the job.
So which of the boys had committed the murder? And what could the science reveal? Police believed there was a hierarchy to the small killer clown group of Pandy Johnson, Nuku and Fournier, which was supported by the hundreds of documents found on the suspects and at the various scenes. Pandy Johnson and Nuku in particular were prolific writers. Handwritten lists included the instructions to swipe all you can and drug him and secure for delivery immediately. Handwriting analysis determined it was written by the group's leader, Pandy Johnson. On another page, the instruction to buy decent-sized hog ties was in Nuku's handwriting, but witnesses would recall it being dictated to him by Pandy Johnson.
The documents showed a level of planning prior to Dean being killed, along with other evidence from witnesses, phones, established for us that Pandy Johnson was the leader of the three. He was one who really called the shots.
But why Pandy Johnson wanted Dean Brown killed, or exactly how they were connected, still wasn't clear. Investigators always said finding DNA on the cable ties on Dean Brown's body would be a key piece of evidence. But forensic scientists weren't that optimistic due to bloodstaining. How would you get DNA on a cable tie anyway?
So, for example, if you were handling a cable tie, you have probably transferred some of your DNA onto it. The smooth side's unlikely to pick up much DNA, but we can see the other side is ridged, so even just by drawing your thumb across it, you've probably sloughed off enough of your skin cells that hopefully we will be able to detect you on there.
And if I was then closing it, I mean, there's a little bit of, you know, I'm exerting some force onto that. Would that mean that I left more DNA on the cable tie?
Yeah, more likely. There'd be more DNA being transferred onto there.
The question was whether the rough ridges had collected enough skin cells to show up against the blood staining.
The expectation would be there'd be a lot of DNA from Mr. Brown on those samples, and we'd be incredibly fortunate to pick up DNA from many other individuals, which is likely to be at a much lower level.
What did you actually discover?
Not only did we detect Mr. Brown, we actually detected another individual, and in fact that extra DNA corresponded to Mr. Nuku.
Was it a strong result?
It was a strong result. So the probability of obtaining that mixture of DNA, if it had come from somebody other than Mr. Nuku, is 90,000 million.
That sounds a lot.
It's a pretty big number.
Anything over a million is regarded as extremely strong support, the strongest results scientists can give. A different cable tie revealed another extremely strong DNA link, this time to Rhys Fournier. Further DNA analysis would link Carl Nuku to the blood-stained overalls found in the suspect's Auckland house, and his palm print was on one of the hammers. But questions remained, including why Dean Brown's body was taken from Wellington to New Plymouth.
It doesn't make any sense what they did, but we know they put him in the car, they drove to Palmerston where they spent several hours socialising.
Nuku was heard by a witness asking for a chainsaw.
The mind boggles as to what they might have wanted that for.
The other suspect, Fournier, had stayed behind.
He stayed in Wellington and took care of the clean-up at the address, and then he got a bus the following day up to Auckland. Pandy Johnson and Nuku left Palmerston North later that night, then drove through to New Plymouth, where they put him in the garage at Drake Street.
They got to New Plymouth early morning the next day, Friday. That afternoon they left for Wellington, seemingly because of a prior commitment.
Pandy Johnson had previously arranged to take a couple of friends of his to the Ragamuffin concert in Rotorua the following day. So he and Nuku picked up these girls, drove them to Rotorua.
By Saturday morning, they were in Rotorua, where they used Dean Brown's cash card at an ATM. It's likely later that same day they drove to Auckland to rendezvous with Fournier.
The next confirmed sightings we have for them is when they were back in New Plymouth on the Sunday afternoon in Drake Street.
In the 3 days following the murder, the suspects clocked up over 1,700 kilometres before they drove back into Drake Street. But what was the motive for the murder?
As far as the motive goes, it's, for me, unclear. It appears that these three had befriended him, and he appeared to go along with it. But, you know, you're not a friend when you get killed by someone.
Police established Dean Brown moved to Wellington in December, about a month before he was killed.
We believe it was drug-related link between Dean and Pandy Johnson.
At the trial, evidence was given that Brown invested a few thousand dollars in a drug deal with Pandy Johnson, who was a heavy pee user, possibly using the drugs, then killing Dean Brown rather than pay him back.
I think it came down to money. Dean had sold his caravan for him. They killed him on the Thursday, and by the Saturday, they'd cleaned out his account. That really is the only reason I can... As I say, it's still a bit of a mystery.
It's money, drugs, whatever. I mean, what came out in the trial, I mean, it was obviously drug-related, a lot of it. And they needed the money.
Dean Brown's parents attended the trial, dismayed to hear their son's reputation attacked due to the drugs link.
The bloody lies that we had to listen to and to hear Dean's name denigrated as much as it wasn't fair. He was a recreational user. He'd smoked pot. I think at times he had dabbled, unfortunately, in pee, but he certainly wasn't
an addict.
And that was proven in the trial. The toxicology tests were presented, so he wasn't a heavy user at all.
At the end of the 5-week trial, the jury returned guilty verdicts for Pandy Johnson and Nuku, but not guilty for Fournier.
I was a little bit frustrated, I have to say, or disappointed with the fact that Mr. Fournier was not convicted of anything.
Mortified?
He just walked out of a bloody court.
When we charged the three, that was done under careful consideration, and, you know, we stand by the decision to charge the three with the murder of Dean.
Pandy Johnson and Nuku were sentenced to life imprisonment to serve a minimum of 18 years before being considered for parole. Dean's parents, relieved at the length of the sentence, still grieve the loss in such violent circumstances of a son they never got to say goodbye to. For the investigators, the end of the trial was closure to a year-long inquiry covering much of the North Island and many thousands of hours of work.
I like the fact that the science has an application that does some good for society and plays an important part in our justice system.
Dean died unnecessarily. Our investigation was to identify who had committed this terrible murder and really bring them to court.
There was evidence from every crime scene, weapons, DNA, fingerprints, evidence of cell phones, writings of the accused. The evidence was overwhelming, I felt.
Nothing can replace the loss of a son, but what science provided was evidence of who murdered Dean Brown, some answers for his parents, and justice for his killers.